Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I'm here with Hal Guerin of Audit Executive Advisory Services. How you doing, Hal?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you doing today?
Great, man. So, Hal, you and I met on LinkedIn. We've been kind of LinkedIn buddies for a couple of months, and we really share a lot of the same ethos, a lot of the same sort of desire to help elevate our profession to the next level. So I just was excited to get you on the Ethics Experts to kind of pick your brain, hear about what you're seeing and kind of hear some more about your perspective. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got to where you're at now? Tell us about your services and kind of what your career path is into this this industry.
Sure. So I would be what you would probably call an accidental internal auditor by background. Going through college, I didn't know the profession of internal audit even existed, and I was so aligned to, you know, the CPA track, and I stumbled into it, not making a long story really long, stumbled into internal audit. Internal audit has been a thread throughout my career, including having served as the chief audit executive for two organizations. I've also have some background and experience in strategic planning, mergers and acquisitions. When I worked for a bank, not only internal audit, I had compliance, physical and investigative security reporting to me. I've done some investor relations work. And I also serve in the capacity of one of the senior leadership to the professionals association that supports the internal audit profession, the Institute of Internal Auditors. Most recently, I've been doing some consulting, writing, blogging, LinkedIn participation. I also serve as sales director for a organization called Mefford Associates that provides content to chief audit executives and is one of the leading producers of online on-demand virtual training for internal audit professionals.
So what was it that sort of prompted you to kind of go out on your own? You were kind of on an in-house team, and then now you're kind of this, you know, for lack of a better term, sort of an internal audit evangelist to help kind of push these tactics and techniques out to industry.
Yeah, no, my position, quite frankly, was eliminated during some downsizing at the Institute of Internal Auditors. You know, if you've been in business long enough, you know how the whole cycle works, right? You know, you're really successful and the business goes through a little bit of challenge, and then, you know, some people have to find other opportunities to do things. And so it was a good break for me. I had been there 7 years. I had led a number of strategic initiatives for the perfect, and it gave me an opportunity to do, you know, some other things as well that I've always wanted to do.
So now you're kind of out in the marketplace, and what's the number one thing that you're seeing? Like if I set up a soapbox for you to stand on right now and to kind of talk about your perspective or to kind of preach about the thing that everyone's kind of getting wrong or the next kind of, you know, leg of the journey to really elevate this thing, what kind of leakage are you seeing in the profession right now?
Yeah, and I don't want to speak just about internal audit, because I think, you know, I want to think about, you know, internal audit, compliance, risk management as sort of a collective space, right, of professionals who are, you know, serving their organizations to make their organizations better. A couple of things come to mind, Nick. One is going to be that, you know, and this is the statement everybody makes, but obviously the pandemic and the coronavirus and all of that has changed things dramatically. You know, I have been talking to a number of chief audit executives over the last few weeks, and every single one of them, except for one, has been working from home, and their teams have been working from home for 6 straight months.
Right.
You know, one is just returning back to the office now, and they're figuring out the protocols associated with that. And in the conversations with them, the conversations have shifted, and I think this applies to compliance teams, risk management teams, anybody who's been managing a set of professionals to serve their organization, to serve their boards, to serve the governance structure in their organization, but doing it in a much more remote environment than they ever have before. And the problem I'm seeing is a couple of things. One is, people are feeling like they've managed to be incredibly effective. people learned how to work from home. They can put their head down. They can concentrate on what they need to accomplish. They figured out how to work the technology, and they can get stuff done. There's varying productivity, but they can get stuff done. But the offset to that is that a lot are struggling with effectiveness. They figured out how to be efficient, but they struggled with effectiveness because any of those professions, any of those risk-related professions in an organization, the relationship with the key people in the organization serves as a pipeline of knowledge as to what's going on. Whether it's active conversation or it's just getting up and walking the halls and having those hallway conversations. And a chief audit executive I spoke to recently used this phrase, and he said, "Hal, I've been with this organization for 13 years. I know everybody and they know me, and I've worked out relationships. But I feel like," and here's the quote, "I feel like I'm operating on the fumes of having been in a physical office environment. And when does that tank start to run empty?" And I think that's, you know, it's so critical because these professions, internal audit, compliance, risk management, ethics professionals, all need to be in the middle of what's going on to really know what's going on.
Yeah, and to be effective, right? I mean, first of all, I mean, good on this guy for being so kind of actualized to even be tuned into this tank or whatever this fuel tank is called. So what advice would you give somebody in that kind of a situation? Because it's probably not an uncommon situation given the sort of new normal we're dealing with.
We just did, or 2 days ago, I just did with someone else, a virtual roundtable of chief audit executives.
Yeah.
And the conversation gravitated to this as one of the topics. And the thought was, if you haven't done it recently, pull out the org chart. Look at everyone at a minimum. If you're the chief compliance officer, you're the chief audit executive, you're the CRO, you're leading one of these functions.
Right.
Look at that org chart and say, who are the key influencers in the organization, regardless of the level they're in? Who are the key people in the organization? Who on my peer, all the people on my peer level and everybody who's superior in the organization? And basically do a maturity model analysis. How important is that person from a relationship standpoint for me being able to know what's going on in the organization and them, and making sure I remain and my staff remain relevant to the organization? How important are they? And rate that 1 to 5. And where is the status of my relationship? 1 to 5. Do a basic gap analysis. And then go and say, I better do something about those gaps that exist if you're being true to yourself. Whether that's call them up, set up a Zoom meeting, because it's not going to be, and for some people, it may not be anytime soon. It may not be, hey, let's go to lunch.
Right.
You're not doing anything after work. Let's go grab a drink. You know, it may be a little bit more formalized, a little bit more structured, a little bit more stilted, you know, because you may not be swapping text messages with the CFO.
Right.
Yeah. You know, on a day-to-day basis. But if you don't invest, if you don't invest in those relationships now, they're slipping away from you.
And so I love that approach. It's such a simple kind of gap analysis that can give somebody some kind of marching orders or some action items to start kind of addressing this thing. Mm-hmm. Where do you see, like, this is kind of a natural thing if you're already tuned into it, right? Like this individual who was talking to you was probably, he was already thinking about this stuff. There's a lot of people who get into this game, and I'm not just saying internal audit, I'm saying, you know, this broader kind of compliance risk game, whatever, who don't even really tune into those things. So what advice would you give one of those people who maybe they haven't thought about it before, or they're not really sold on, hey, I need to have relationships with all these sort of other, you know, departments in order to be more effective? What can you kind of round out on that perspective?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you look in the mirror and you go and you say, look, why am I here? You know, why am I in this organization? And when you boil it down, it really comes down to, I'm here to add value, because if I'm not adding value, I'm not relevant to the organization. So, you know, to add value, you have to be relevant to the key people in the organization, whether that's the board, the audit committee, the risk committee, the governance structure, the C-suite, the key decision makers in the organization. You have to be viewed as relevant. Not, I think I'm relevant. What do they think?
Right.
And I think some people have had the aha moment. I thought I was more relevant than I was, and now I'm sitting at home. I can't engage anyone
right
in what I need to talk to them about, let alone how many times have I had this, I didn't know that was going on. Boy, I wish I would have known that reaction to things that you might have known more about if you were physically in the office environment. So to me, there's this, you know, mirror relationship. To add value, you have to be relevant. And to be relevant, you have to be viewed as relevant if you're going to add value.
Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing.
And how do you do that? It comes from relationships. If the people in the organization don't know who you are, then what chance do you have at the end of the day of being viewed as relevant or important? And if you're not viewed as relevant or important to the organization, its pursuit of its mission, its pursuit of its vision, its strategic objectives, then you can't add value.
Yeah.
And so it's that logic train that, yes, I get it. I'm here to put my head down and help crank out work that might be, you know, are we complying with laws and regulations? Is the internal control structure what it's supposed to be? You know, have we identified the risks we're supposed to, and how are we managing and mitigating the risk? All of that's important. But if they don't view what you have to say as relevant, what's the point of the work?
Yeah, there's no point in the work. It's just moving rocks from one side of the yard to the other side, and then just to come in the next day and move them back to the other side. But there's kind of an opportunity in this, from my perspective. You know, relevance or essentialism or whatever is kind of like beauty, in that it's in the eye of the beholder. And to your point, if you can have a relationship with somebody and you can talk across the table to them and you can add some value to them, then you can start to kind of build toward that relevance that you're talking about. So what are some ideas that you would have for somebody who's like, okay, well, yeah, I haven't really had that kind of eyeball to eyeball conversation with myself, looking myself in the mirror and really kind of dialing in as to whether, you know, I'm actually effective, or I just think I'm effective or relevant or whatever. What are some examples of ways that somebody who's trying to get out of this sort of potentially irrelevant sort of, you know, pigeonhole that they're in, to start providing some of that value or start building some of those relationships in some of these separate areas that we can really be complementary to?
Yeah, and I'll start with, I want to answer that question, but I want to start with it, you know, that's going to sound a little doom and gloom, but I don't mean it to be.
Okay.
You know, if you weren't relevant, whatever that role is, if you weren't relevant going into the crisis, it's very hard to all of a sudden pop your head up and say, I want to be relevant now.
Okay.
Right? At the beginning of the crisis, and the advice I had given to chief audit executives as an example, when they would call me and say, you know, how it's first time I'm managing a remote workforce. I've never worked from home. I feel like this, I feel like that. What do I do? And I said, start actively calling people. Set up call programs that might have been more drop-bys when you were walking the halls. It now has to be more structured. Who do I need to touch base with once a week, once a month, once a quarter, and force yourself to do it. Pick your head up and have those structured conversations. You know, risk professionals, you know, they want, generally, stereotypically want structure. Build the structure, force yourself to do it, because otherwise it's so easy to fall into the trap of, I'm busy. I'm not saying I'm not busy. From the moment I get up in the morning, you know, I'm go to my home office or wherever I do my work at home right now, and I'm cranking all day long, you know. And then, you know, and my spouse comes and says, "Are you going to stop working so we can have dinner?" I'm not saying you're not busy.
Right.
But are you relevant to the organization through all that busyness? And so I think, you know, forcing yourself to do call programs, doing that gap analysis is critical. An example that comes to mind is two, actually. A chief audit executive I was speaking with recently who changed jobs 2 months ago. They left one company, became chief audit executive of another. So they're working in one state. The company is headquartered in another. There's no point to relocate right now because he'd just be sitting at a new home in the new state.
Right.
Right. No relationships. Has seen these people face to face once, and otherwise it's all been video.
Right.
So put yourself in that mindset. If he isn't working on relationships developments from the beginning, they don't know who he is.
Right.
They have their perceptions of the staff he inherited. And how do you move forward?
Right.
And then you flip that the other way. Another chief audit executive I was speaking to a few weeks ago said, "I just got a brand new CFO. And they're my administrative boss. I have no relationship." And on the first call with them, they said something that made my jaw drop. And they said, not mine, but the person I was talking to, and they said, "So other than SOX compliance work, what does the internal audit function actually do here?" And they went, "Oh my God, have I got an educational chore on my hand?" Because right. I can't even go to their office and say, "Let's go to lunch. We need to chat."
Yeah. And to your point, that can kind of go both ways. That's kind of an opportunity if you can seize it. And say, okay, look, this person kind of, they may have some misconceptions, but they're kind of a blank slate. I can help them form an accurate opinion of what we actually do and help kind of, if I can speak their language, you know, so to speak, I guess. If I can speak their language, I can really show them the value that we provide at a time when they're looking for some stability, right? Somebody's new coming into the organization. They're trying to get the sea legs. They're trying to see the lay of the land. They're looking for help and perspective to figure out which way is up. We can help those new folks and see that as an opportunity rather than a threat. Obviously, there's some kind of threat embedded in there because, to your point, there's some re-education that needs to be done. But like everything else, you know, perception is reality, and we can sometimes often influence that perception through conversation, through influence, through persuasion, or whatever. And many times it's sort of information-based, especially if we're actually adding value and we can speak to it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you think about another suggestion is, you know, and you know, it doesn't matter if let's just say you're the CCO, the chief compliance officer. It doesn't have to be, you know, any of the other functions. It could be any of them, but, you know, and so where is that relationship maybe not as strong as you'd like it to be? Or there's a new person in the organization in a key role. Don't make the conversation about what you need.
Correct.
Make the conversation about what they need. We haven't spoken in a while. You're new to the organization. How can I help you? Because we're all going through a very challenging time right now. What do you need from me? Because that's where the relationship gets developed. If it's all about, "Well, I got some really bad news to tell you, operating manager, chief operating officer, there's some really bad stuff going on in your area and we need to talk about it," they're going to be like, "There they go again."
Correct.
You know, and, you know, the early on in the crisis, you know, using internal audit as an example, you know, there are some chief audit executives that I was like, "Guys, what are you thinking?" So as an example, chief financial officer calls the CAE, they're sitting at home, you know, and says, "I really need some help with fill in the blank, whatever that I need the help is. And the typical reaction from someone in internal audit is, I can't do that. That would violate my independence and objectivity. And what I wanted to do when I heard that from some of these folks is grab them by the shoulders and say, excuse my language, screw that.
Right.
Right now in a crisis, you figure out how to deal with independence and objectivity issues at a later date.
Correct.
You may tell that CFO, I can't do, let me think about it. Let me get back to you tomorrow. And you may come back and say with something that's, you know, I can't do that, what you specifically asked, but I can do this. And this is why I think it's even better. And this is how it'll help you. But roll up your sleeves and help.
Yeah, we need to tap into that that natural reciprocity that's in all of us and lead with value. And you said it best, right? Our role is to serve the organization, and our role is to serve, is to serve these other functions at some level. But in order to do that, there's a certain, you know, willingness, to your point, to roll up our sleeves and jump in and see what we can do to help. And I think if we can lead with that and understand that we're servants at heart, and if we're doing a good job, that means that we're serving the organization well, then it's not that hard to kind of balance picking up some new work to try to build that relationship in the context of all the other things that you have to get done.
And it might not be traditional work. It might not be work you really want to do. It might definitely would be something you don't want to do long term. And for an example like internal audit, where you might, you know, and likely functionally report to the audit committee, you may need to, as the chief audit executive, tell the audit committee chair, look, the organization has asked me to do this. Under normal circumstances, I won't. But this is what I volunteer to do. Here's why it makes sense. Yes, I might not be able to objectively audit that area in the future, but I'll deal with that later.
Right.
You need to know. And this is how it might impact my ability to complete the audit plan. That's the obligation you have. And if you've laid it out well, I have no doubt the audit committee chair is going to say, thanks for telling me. Please do exactly what you just said.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you reach out to somebody, right, and or whatever, right, somebody comes to you and says, hey, can you help me with this? Hey, let me sleep on it. I'm going to get back to you tomorrow. I come back to you tomorrow and say, listen, I have some kind of objectivity issues and some kind of, you know, perception of independence issues that won't let me do exactly what you're talking about, but I can do X, Y, and Z and so forth. Even if they don't take you up on an X, Y, and Z, they weren't met with just a no. They were met with a no, but, or, hey, I can do this. And at the end of the day, if we're talking about, we're kind of talking about branding, right? We need to maintain our personal brand within our organization. We need to influence our department's brand within our broader organization. So we're really kind of talking about this personal branding thing, which really means we're really trying to persuade people and sell people, so to speak, on us being of value to them. And I think we can get overly obsessed with, is each brick in this thing, you know, placed at the right spot? Well, we're trying to build a wall, right? And so you're going to be doing a lot of different things in the pursuit of this personal branding. And that's going to be a lot of interactions and a lot of touch points with people if you're going to be successful. And I think if we can move past getting over obsessed with the one thing and look more broadly at, this is an ongoing process of us trying to be helpful, us trying to influence the perception of our organization within our broader company. Those are things that we can start knocking some of these dominoes down and start to get us in the spot where something like this happens and everybody's working from home and everybody's in these disparate places, where someone on the other end of the line is going to pick up that phone and not be like, here comes another no, you know, I'm trying to do my own job. And here comes Nick calling me up and telling me I can't do this thing. No, I want to pick the phone up because Nick is helpful and he provides a good perspective and saves me trouble and saves me whatever, as I'm trying to do my own job. That's the kind of end zone that we're really pushing toward, I think.
Right. And, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't like this terminology, you know, and I don't want to necessarily use it, but it's the way a CFO might look at these functions, you know, as a cost center, as an expense, you know, and if they view you as adding value, they view you as, you know, I asked for help and it's tangible how they help the organization in a crisis. Then when the pencil gets sharpened because we're revenue challenged And we've got to look for opportunities to cut costs, because the next earnings call, you know, the quarter ain't looking so good, and we may disappoint analysts, and we got to have a success story to tell on that analyst phone call, because we're going to miss our EPS target. If you don't think functions that are perceived as not adding value and not rising to the challenge and helping the organization when we really needed it, whatever it was,
right,
then you're going to be part of the expense reduction calculation, like it or not.
It's just the fact of it. It's just the fact of the matter on how human beings make decisions, irrespective of what the facts are. And I think, to your point, it's on each of us, it's on every single one of us, to make ourselves indispensable to our organizations.
Right.
And no one's going to just naturally, like, if you're waiting for, or if you're counting on, to your point, you're counting on sort of corporately your organization looking at your department as indispensable, and you're not doing those extra steps to build those threads in the tapestry of relationships for your brand, then you're rolling the dice at some level, and you're not taking control over something that you really do have influence over. Why do you think people in compliance or people in internal audit or in these kind of functions, why do you think this isn't sort of second nature to them? Why is this a conversation that you have to coach people on? And why are we talking about this right now? I'm saying that we need to talk about it, obviously, but
yeah.
What do you think it is? What do you think's missing at that core?
I think, it's not necessarily going to be very flattering, my diagnosis of your to answer your question there, but we're, human nature for most people is that you find a comfort zone and you don't realize you fell into a state of complacency. And as the world was rocking along through 2019 and transitioned into 2020, I think a lot of people in a lot of these roles felt comfortable. They had worked out a sense of comfort. Here's what I do. Here's where I believe I add value. Right. I feel really good about my relevance. And then the world changed. And the question is, going back to stuff we talked about before, if you don't feel as relevant, why? Well, it's likely that you either got complacent and didn't realize it. And so now it's time to reset, if you haven't done it already and it's not too late, it's time to reset the clock before it is too late. And that is back to what we've been talking about. It's about adding value and relevance, and you get there through relationships. How do people feel about what you do for the organization?
Right.
Not what you do tangibly. You know what you do tangibly. You know you're adding value, right? You get up every morning and you go to work, and I'm doing something important here, right? I know it's relevant. But as you pointed out, Nick, it's not what you believe.
Right.
It's what everybody else believes.
And I think, from a meritocracy perspective, if you are in fact adding value, right, if you don't have a false positive on the value that you're adding, well then through a conversation, you should be able to articulate that and convey that at some level. Now, whether they see the same value in it as you do is kind of up for debate, but the binary kind of, do they see any value in it or no value in it, can at least be addressed through a conversation. And there's kind of three buckets, I think, that we can all kind of fall into. One is other people in our organization are fans of us. Mm-hmm. Other end is other people in our organization don't see any value in us at all, or they're not fans of us. And then there's this middle bucket where there's no opinion. Where do you obviously we'd want to be in the good bucket, but where do you see people kind of fall in one or the other? And what kind of successful ways have you seen someone transition from that first bucket or that second bucket into the good bucket?
Yeah, the first reaction I have is that, the adage of, especially in roles in an organization where you may be the messenger of not good news, is it's much more important to be respected than liked. You know, we all want to be liked, you know, but if you overfocus on being liked, that doesn't necessarily get you help get the job done because you need to be respected, right? Right? So I think, you know, don't go on a, I would not advocate going on a publicity campaign to try and improve your like scores, you know, because that is not the role. I think it goes back to, you know, again, you know, whether you do the formal thing like I suggested, pulling out the org chart or just go through the mental exercise in your head. What is the state of my relationship with the key people in the organization? And the people that sometimes get forgotten are the influencers.
Right.
They may not be sitting across the top of the org chart, but they influence other people in the organization about their belief structure, what they think about the organization, what they think about the leadership, what they think about the values, the ethics, the ability of the organization to achieve its mission and vision. Those influencers, include them on the list. And am I valued and respected by them? And if not, why not?
Yeah.
And the key, the biggest clue is going to be, you know, well, when you were in the physical office environment, and you knew there was a meeting going on in the conference room, and you go, well, why wasn't I invited to that one as you walked by and you see all these people in there? Then you go, wait a minute, you know, the chief compliance officer walks by, and they go, wait a minute, the head of internal audit's there, the head of risk management's there, the CEO, the whole suite's in there, key operating management, why am I not in there, right? When you're sitting at home, unless somebody clues you in that you weren't invited to the meeting, you didn't even know it happened.
Right.
Right. But what did you find? If you start finding out things, whether you're in a physical office environment or remote office environment, the more you find out things that fit into that category, that bucket of, I didn't know that. Boy, I wish I would have known that.
Right.
I didn't realize that meeting was going on and I didn't get an invitation to it. Those are the canaries in the coal mine. Those are the clues, you know. And if you don't get proactive to not, no, pick up the phone and start giving someone a hard time about the fact that I should have been there, you know, but start diagnosis. Start the diagnosis as to, help me understand if, you know, because you're looking for the clues as to what's going on in their head about why were you not thought of. To be told that, to be informed, think about the, you know, the RACI diagrams and stuff like that. When should I be informed? When should I be consulted? When should I be, you know, responsible and accountable? But a lot of our roles is, that the C and the I, when should I have been consulted and when should I have been informed? And if that's not happening to the level you're satisfied with, if it's happening at a lesser frequency than 6 months ago, there's the clues.
Yeah, those are
react to it, act on it, but don't be defensive about it. Because if you're defensive about it, you've drawn a line in the sand that's just going to make things worse.
Yeah, and I think that last point is such a big point because like it's on us. Like life is not happening to us. Whatever outcomes we get, we've organized our life, whether sort of consciously or subconsciously, we've organized our life perfectly to get that outcome. So to start attacking the person for not inviting you, I think it really starts with yourself to say, well, why wasn't I top of mind for this person? To your point, why was I not top of mind to this person to where they thought it was a no-brainer for me to show up? Is it because they don't see my value? Is it because I'm obnoxious and just say no to everything and, you know, put brakes or, you know, tie up, I don't know, bricks to their ankles as they're trying to swim? Like, is it something that I'm doing? Do I need to be more persuasive? Do I need to lead with more reciprocity to see how can I help you out? Those are all pieces of the puzzle. And I think what I've seen a lot of folks who get into situations like this do, they say, well, the rules are in place. Of course I should have been there. Of course I should have been a part of this meeting. Well, we all know that people don't follow all these rules all the time. They do what they want and their behaviors are a function really of what they care about. And so if we can get into their brain a little bit and kind of be helpful to them, and like I said, kind of tap some of that reciprocity, the odds of us rising to that top of mind position on that C and on that I are going to just be a lot higher naturally versus trying to force somebody into it and they begrudgingly start inviting you to things.
And if you go back to, you know, one of the things we were talking about a little bit ago, if you force yourself to do that call program, especially when you're sitting at home, but it works when you're in a physical environment too. What frequency do I need to be checking in with these key people? Some of them are going to be more frequent than others. When you're doing that, I can guarantee what will happen will be, you know what? I didn't think about it, but I should invite you to that meeting we're having tomorrow, next week. Because you brought yourself back into, because otherwise it's out of sight, out of mind.
Got it.
Right? You got to put yourself back on their radar, not wait for them to come to you.
And that is kind of speaking into this broader kind of theory that I've had, that during this whole COVID thing, this huge disruption that we're going through, there's a massive opportunity for us to elevate from this sort of kiddie table to the, you know, to the cool kids table or whatever you want to call it. And I think it's for what a lot of the stuff you're talking about is forcing us out of our comfort zone, is forcing us to develop new skills, new protocols, new whatever, in order to have those connections with people. What do we do with the insecurity that comes along with this stretching? You know what I'm saying? It's like, hey, I've been comfortable. I've been sort of fat and happy, so to speak. I've been just crushing these audits. I've been crushing my policy management, all, you know, whatever's kind of part and parcel of my function. Now, because of this work from home, because I'm fighting against this out of sight, out of mind type of a, you know, I don't know, like front, you know, it's like a weather front that's coming in. I'm fighting against that. And it's really making me feel uncomfortable. It's forcing me to be a little bit more extroverted than I like, or it's a little bit less structured than I'm sort of used to and most comfortable in. What do you do with someone who's feeling those kind of insecurities about this new sort of facet of our job that we're going to need to be good at in order to stay effective and stay kind of top of mind over the next decade?
Yeah, I think one is, first, you have to keep in mind that if you're leading a function, internal audit compliance risk management, in your organization, you have a staff of people that are looking to you and emulating your behavior. So you have an accountability and a responsibility to demonstrate for them the behaviors you want them to do as well, because they need to be doing a lot of the same things. It's not just cranking out work. Then I think the other point is, you know, unless you're planning on retiring sometime soon, you know, how much do you like your job? How much do you want to keep your job? And how much do you want to be thinking about looking for a job in the current environment?
Good point.
And, you know, and if that doesn't create enough fear and anxiety to make you want to stretch and do things you don't want to do, then suffer the consequences. I mean, I don't mean to be so brutal and blunt, but that's it.
Right.
You know, because I go back to something I said before, you know, to a stereotypical CFO, every FTE is a number in a spreadsheet.
Right.
It's not, I really like Nick. You know, he or she really might like you, but at the end of the day, you're a number in a spreadsheet when push comes to shove and we got to do something here, you know. And the last thing you want to do, you know, CROs as a great example are elevating their visibility in organizations, and some of them are doing a great job now where they're actually reporting to the governance structure, to boards and audit committees. Not as many as that
we're talking about.
Not as many as would like, you know, I think we all like, but you know, certainly the chief audit executives are.
Right.
You do not want the CFO or the CEO having a conversation with the audit committee chair saying, you know what, I just don't think they're getting it. You know, I just don't think they're the right person for this organization long term because they're not really adding value. Yeah, they're getting work done and they're delivering work to you, but they're not getting work done. They're not adding value. They're not adding value. They're not really relevant to me in my role. As a matter of fact, case in point, I just asked them a few weeks ago to do this really important thing for me, and they told me no.
Yep.
You know, and so, you know, if you know, it won't take long for the C-suite to influence the key board members about your place in the organization.
Yeah, and I think on that point, like if we're not doing this persuasion thing that we've kind of been talking about for the last, you know, hour here, if you're not doing that persuasion thing, and there's not new sort of deposits made into the account of value that you're adding, there's just, you know, debits for your salary, well then that you become increasingly more expensive to your organization over time as your salary rises, right? And if you're not doing things to become indispensable, to show that, hey, I'm adding this extra value, to be speaking into the ears of folks so that when those behind the door conversations are being had, you at least have a champion, or even better, a couple of champions in the room that say, yeah, that guy gets this kind of a salary, but he does X, Y, Z. Well, like put this person at the bottom of the list. If we're not building those firewalls around ourselves, then we're naturally going to be perceived to be adding less value potentially as we continue to sort of just grow within our organizations.
And I think you don't even have to be, I agree completely, I think you're exactly right. You don't have to be as dramatic or draconian as I said, mm-hmm. but let's say you had turnover in your department and you need to fill those positions and you get the, oh, absolutely reaction, or you get the, well, now's not the right time for that. Exactly. You come with the next expense that says, you know what, I need to add to staff and here's the reason why. And you're surprised that you got the no. Now's not the right time, when you had the wheels greased before and it was sort of a slam dunk. You need to hire this third party to bring in subject matter expertise to get something done. And you get the qualified or unqualified, no, not right now. You know, so it doesn't have to be that you have to feel your job's at risk or your staff, current staff's at risk. It's, you know, what's on the, what, you know, the stuff that's on the horizon that you know that you're going to need to cost more money, and somebody, you have that built up.
Right. Trust.
Reservoir of credibility that, you know, well, if Nick's asking for that, then by all means, they must really need that, because they know right now is not a good time to ask.
Exactly.
As opposed to, what are you thinking? You know, do you not understand what's going on in this organization reaction? Now is not the good time, you know? And so, you know, it's investing in that all the time.
Yeah. And it's just kind of a way of being. It's kind of turning on this function basically inside of our minds to say, hey, I got to obviously be tight on my technical stuff, but I also got to be tight on the personal stuff. And I got to be tight on the internal persuasion stuff, so that when I need something, someone's not going to sort of second guess it all the time, or I'm not going to have to put a 20 slide PowerPoint presentation and stand in front of, you know, the board, so to speak, and make my case. That trust will have been built, to your point. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I think the people that get it the most are the people leading these types of functions who either came in from another role in the organization, or they have aspirations for other roles beyond chief risk officer or chief audit executive. They have aspirations for other roles because they understand, and I don't mean to be say it this way, but it is a bit of it is a game, how the game is played.
They play the game.
You know, and it is not just the work I get done and the quality of what my department produces, but it's managing perception, coming full circle to what we've been talking about. And if you haven't been investing in managing perception, you know, and I close that back out, then, you know, perception drives relevance. Am I perceived as relevant? And relevance gives you, is the key to adding value. You can't unlock the door that says add value here, you can't unlock it unless you're viewed as relevant, because you're not involved in what you need to be involved in.
Yeah, and if you're not viewed as relevant, then you run the risk of people not even noticing the value that you're adding, to your point. Mm-hmm. Well, I love this conversation, man. I feel thankful to have met you.
Same here.
You just keep adding, you know, I love the stuff that you share. You're so thoughtful with your the comments and the articles and stuff that you kind of bring to the community. And I really love this conversation a lot. I feel like we're touching on this compliance 3.0 thing where we're moving from kind of check the box and CYA to really kind of being effective. And there's obviously a bunch of tangible sort of tactical boots on the ground things to do in terms of changing our policies and making these more accessible and so forth. But there's also this sort of internal work that you're so adept at sort of articulating that really we can get a lot of bang for our buck. I mean, even if we're just spending a little bit of time each week to build those relationships, and if we can start to tune into the intangible value that those relationships are going to feed, not only into our, you know, our own careers, but more broadly to the brand that our department has, whether we recognize it or not within the organization, we can really begin to elevate. So Hal, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
How can people find you? How can people get in touch with you? Tell us how we can get at you.
I mean, the simple thing is the email. It's h.garyn@gmail.com, Audit Executive Advisory Services.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Hal, for
thank you, Nick,
the day with us and being so generous with your insights. I'll see you on LinkedIn, man.
Sounds good. My pleasure. Thanks, Nick.